This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan. Me and my 88.
Welcome to another episode of Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. I'm sitting here with my cohort, the great engineer, Brian Hoogenboom. And we have some wonderful guests on the show tonight who I'll introduce in a few minutes. But first, I want to play a couple of songs. The first song is a song that was inspired in 2004. That was a big year for baseball if you're a Red Sox fan. The Red Sox had gone for, I think, 83 years without winning a World Series. We were the hard luck team of the whole country. The Red Sox and the Cubs. Everybody wondered, would they ever win the World Series? Well, my son, Christopher, grew up in the dark days when we never went all the way. And I tell people that he learned how to add between spring training and the All-Star break, because every year the Red Sox would go way ahead. He learned subtraction the day after the All-Star break, because they would always plummet and would never make it. So when he was a little boy, he asked me to promise him that if the Red Sox ever won the World Series, that he and I would go to the victory parade. Well, 2004 came along, and the Red Sox had won three games. My son, who was now a student at the University of South Carolina, called me and said, "Are we going, Dad?" I said, "Are we going where?" He said, "You know, to the victory parade. They've won three games." And if you know the Red Sox, I had to tell my son, "Son, you know nothing about the Red Sox. We've won three games in 75, in 67, in 46, I think. This means nothing." Anyway, I said, "I can't go. I got stuff I got to do." When I hung the phone up, my wife rebuked me in a loving way and said, "You are going to the victory parade. You promised your son." Of course, I wanted to go anyway. So we bought the tickets before that last game. And as the train was pulling out to go to the victory parade, my wife yelled across the train yard, "Guess what? They just won." So when we went up to that parade in 2004, this inspired this song. It was a great, great day. And I remember when I left there, I said, "There's got to be a song somewhere. But you got to listen to the third verse, because I promised God that all of my songs would be about Him in some way." So we get around to the spiritual aspect on the third verse. This song is called "Worth the Wait, Ode to 2004.
Worth the wait.
This next song was recorded recently by my band Damascus Road and myself. It's called When Love Walked In.
I could hear Jesus softly.
across the floor. I could hear Jesus softly calling my name. I heard a knock on the door, and as I walked across the floor, I could hear Jesus softly, and he was calling my name.
Our special guests on the show tonight are Dr. Artie Hall and his wife Susan Hall from Florence, South Carolina. Artie and Susan have been faithful to their calling for many years. They're both educators, and both have been active in their local churches throughout their adult life, and they spent 13 years in the nation of Nicaragua. And it's just a great joy to have them on the show. We're going to talk about their journey all the way from when they first accepted Christ and throughout their life. They are retired now and live in Florence and are very active in their church, Lamb's Chapel. So let's go to the interview I had with Artie and Susan several days ago. I've met you both before you were ever a couple.
That's right.
Yes.
So I want to talk to you, Artie, just for a minute, and we'll talk to you, Susie, and I want to just talk about a lot of things. But you and I have something in common, Artie.
Yeah.
We are both from the suburbs of Bishopville, South Carolina.
That's right.
Population is about 3,000, I think, live there.
Yeah.
Lee County. You grew up in town, right?
In town.
What street?
Yeah. Dennis Avenue, mostly.
Yeah.
Seems like we were on Couser Street, Dennis Avenue, finally Jones Circle.
Yeah.
So we kind of, those were the three spots.
And I live 9 miles from Bishopville. Bishopville's the county seat of Lee County. It's known for three things. Let's start with the respectable one is Doc Blanchard. Great football player, Heisman Trophy winner in the 1940s.
Yeah.
He was a sensation. He was from Bishopville. Then there's a blues artist named Drink Small. That's an odd name, Drink Small. But he's from there. And then on the outskirts of Bishopville, the Lee County Lizard Man.
Yes, yes.
Do you want to tell our people who the Lizard Man was?
Yeah. The mysterious creature that would come out at night and harass people and scratch their cars and just other nonsense that went on there through a while.
Bit the chrome off the car, so somebody saw him flying over I-20 with a mule hanging out of his mouth. But yeah, there was this legend that happened. We kind of know the backstory of that. But anyway, it actually made the London, England papers, CBS News.
Yeah, everywhere.
Do you know my cousin Steve Corbett?
Not directly, but yeah.
He married my cousin Becky.
Right, right.
Well, Steve's a logger. He's never been one to go on the stage and grab a microphone. But years ago, it was in Massachusetts. And I'm struggling to write songs, and I'm sending songs here and there and getting rejection. And I turned on the CBS Evening News in Massachusetts now, and it said, we want to take you to Lee County. And they had this whole story about the Lee County Lizard Man that came out of a swamp. And they said, and a local guy wrote this song. Nobody even knew he could sing. So here is my cousin's husband singing the legend of the lizard. I have to admit, I sat there and I said, Lord,
It's not fair. You're not fair. I get turned out everywhere I go. I never had a song recorded. Yeah. And here, a logger, my cousin's husband, who never has gone in front of a microphone, he's singing on the CBS Evening News to the whole country. But anyway, so that's the third thing. And then the fourth thing is Artie Hall.
I don't know about that.
So, and I think I got to know you. You started going out to the Church of God, right?
Yeah, that would have been high school.
And you knew the Mrs. Groves. Was that your connection?
I think that would be the connection, yeah. Okay. And of course, you know, those were the years when you would go to a church to facilitate a romance or something. Not always for the right reasons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So was that why you were there?
Initially, yeah. Yeah. And later it changed.
Then I remember seeing you. I was living in Indiana. Let me see. What year did you graduate from high school?
72.
72.
Yeah, but it was right ahead of that when I was attending that church.
Yeah.
And the youth conference. You did a youth conference in Spartanburg.
That's what I was going to say. I remember seeing you in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Yeah.
They had asked me to speak at the youth convention, the state youth convention. And you were there. I remember you were there.
Yeah.
And gosh, that would have been about 70. I don't know what
it was year. Around 70. It may have been February. February 72, maybe. It was before I got out of high school, but I think that would have been just before May, I guess.
Okay. Now, somebody told me this. I don't know if this is true or not, and we'll cut it out if it's not. But did you receive some kind of calling at that, that convention?
I did. There was a real call to ministry on my life at that point. I didn't really know how that was going to look.
Was it during the altar calls?
Yeah. During one of the altar calls, the Lord just really spoke in my heart. That's the thing. And it was more, I think, just surrendering completely to the Lord.
Yeah.
Because I had grown up around Baptist churches and around the Baptist church in Bishopville, and, you know, as a kid. And at some point very early on, I asked the Lord, well, I had to have been... I think Eisenhower was president. That's how long ago this was.
That's how he was president when I got saved.
Yeah, and I was a little kid, and I asked, felt real conviction, and I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah,
and I asked my mother, "How do I keep from going to hell?" And she sort of swallowed, and then just explained, "Well, you just ask Jesus to forgive you, and you know, et cetera, those kinds of things." So I guess there must have been something I heard in Sunday school that just got me all stirred up. But then there was, after that, a great deal of teenage rebellion, as we all did in those years. And well, some of us more than others. Mine was fairly brief because it was Bishopville. There wasn't much to get into, really. And it was after that, when I started attending the Church of God, that God just really touched my heart once again in a firm way.
So you were how old when you started going to church out there?
I'm 16 and then turned 17 while I was there.
Okay. And you didn't go there a long time, I don't think, did you?
No, just a while.
So you were going there, and then you went off to the youth convention with that youth group.
With that group, yeah.
Okay. And so are you saying that you were born again as a little boy?
Yeah.
And kind of wandered away? Came back. Was it at the church there? Did you go to the altar like a lot of people do?
I did it that one, and in fact, the moment at that church that really touched my life was a fella preaching on hell.
Yeah.
That's not very popular now, but he was, and it really hit me. I thought, man, I'm in trouble, and at that point, the Lord really, really began to just seize my heart, and since that time, you know, for a few years there, I got to USC, just had some... Freshman year was a little rough, spiritually in that sense, but then I finally connected with some really good people, some friends, in fact, we still have. And that was almost 50 years ago now, and that was the time when the Lord really solidified all of that. And And then during that time, too, I received baptism of the Holy Spirit. That was the charismatic aspect of things that were happening at the time. And
there on the campus?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that was when it was.
Did you go to a church called the Shack?
No. I met Sue at Damascus House in Darlington.
Yeah, I'm going to get to Sue in a minute.
Yeah, there. But
I've known her longer than I've known you.
Yeah, a long time. And that's true. But at 19 years old, just a really profound experience with the Lord, of His presence, and that. From then on, there was never any wavering. You know, the Lord was just there.
Okay, and I was going to just go ping pong, but I'm going to talk to you just a little bit more. Were you raised, you went to Baptist Church, mm-hmm. were your mom and dad believers?
Probably believers, but that might have been about as far as it got. Some of it, you know, Christianity in the South, everybody went to church. You know, even the heathens went to church. Just That's everybody right. went to church. And there was a... some of it was cultural, I think, because my family on my dad's side, long line of Baptist preachers, you know, all of that, so it's in the family, but it was to some degree not the using kind of faith. It was just sort of a believing faith, and my mom grew in that some for a few years after that, and they said all the right words. Sometimes actions didn't always show that, but I didn't really grow up with that kind of background. It was more of a you just go to church on Sunday kind of thing, and not much beyond that for those years.
Did you drop out of church for a while in your teenage years?
A little bit, yeah. Probably from around 15, right in there somewhere. I just, I did sing in the Baptist choir some, just when they actually still had choirs and churches, but then kind of dropped out of most all of that for a while, and then got involved in some other things.
So what was it that was it like wanting to see a girl? What caused you to get interested in going out in the country to? You know, my great grandfather was the first pastor of that church.
Okay, I don't know. Something had just really happened in me to be more curious about Christianity. But you know, there was a girl involved. First time I'd gone out to that church was probably more for that reason.
Yeah.
And then once I got there and started listening to the guy, you know, all of a sudden, you know how the Lord is. He'll get you in a situation, you start getting convicted. You know, the Lord just starts dealing with things in your life. And at that point, I knew there was more to it than that. And the girl thing was long gone, and it became more of a spiritual aspect in that.
Do you remember the pastor at the time? Was it Phil Hooser?
Yeah.
Oh, he was a rip snorter, man.
Yeah.
He would pound the pulpit.
And he was
good, though. He was really good.
Had a good word.
Yeah. So, Susie.
Yes.
I met you in December of 1970.
That's right. First Church of God in Darlington.
In Darlington. Mm-hmm. And Darlington is the hometown of the famous NASCAR Raceway.
That's right.
So we had a great revival there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a remarkable revival.
Amazing. Amazing.
And I had just started preaching. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, the pastor, I had known him since I was a little boy, Dave Stevenson. Mm-hmm. And that was right on the heels of the Asbury revival that had happened just a few months before that. And I happened to be visiting my folks, and Dave asked me to share at a youth rally. And then it was wonderful. Then he asked me, said, "What's your schedule like? Can you come back a week from tomorrow? And we just start, and we won't put any limits on it. It might be for one night. It might be for two. We'll play it by ear, you know." And as you know, that second night, I started on Sunday morning, Sunday night, and I won't call all the names out, but there was a girl named Karen, mm-hmm. who was a new believer. She came, she went home, and she dared her brother. She dared him to come. Mm-hmm. And he's owns a funeral home there now, you yep. know. But she said, "You're afraid to come." He said, "No, I'm not." She said, "Then I dare you to come tomorrow night." So he and his girlfriend and another guy and his girlfriend, very popular kids at the school, mm-hmm. they came and they got saved that night.
Yeah.
They went to the altar. And, okay, you were going to that school, right?
I was in junior high.
You were in junior high.
Yeah. I would have been in eighth grade that year.
But I think what happened is the word just spread all over the school mm-hmm. that these four people had
yeah.
come to the Lord.
Yeah. yeah.
And so a great curiosity built. And anyway, revival just broke out. And we had meetings every night for, I think, 21 or 22
Three
days.
3 weeks.
We quit right before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And after about 7 days, I'd run out of every every idea. I mean, I was scrambling.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, at that point, it almost didn't matter. But it really didn't matter the performance of it. Mm-hmm. It was a God thing.
Yeah,
I know the preaching was probably very rambling and all that. But you started coming fairly. Your mom came. I mean,
yeah,
she was there every night.
Yeah, the Betty Stevenson, Pastor Dave's wife, was my father's secretary in his law office.
Oh,
and she had invited my mother to come to church on Sunday night. We were Presbyterians, and we had youth group and other things, but not a Sunday night service. Mm-hmm. And so a year ahead of that, she had started coming, and that was where she actually met Jesus at the altar. At that church. And so that just became Sunday night. She went to church there. In the July of 1970, I had gone to a Methodist church camp meeting mm-hmm. near Greenwood, Newberry, somewhere out in the middle of nowhere,
yeah.
and had gotten saved there. And just...
And how old were you again?
I would have been 13 then.
13 years old.
Yeah. It was the summer between 7th and 8th grade, July 20th, 1970. And so when you came to Darlington, I was a young believer.
Yeah. That would have been about 4 months later, five mm-hmm. months later.
Yeah. But I remember, and I was probably there that first Sunday night when you were there. I don't know. But I know, I remember just the move of the Holy Spirit of God moving. And people, I don't remember everything you said. I do remember you talked a lot about Jesus.
Good.
And then you said,
I'm glad to hear that.
And you'd sit at the piano, and it would either be "Just as I Am" without one plea, or it'd be "The King is Coming." And people from all over would just be at the altar on their knees, praying,
it was like
crying,
a wave.
It was a wave, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah. It would be like a wave. And I was just, I mean, I had the real consciousness that it wasn't my giftings that was doing anything. It was just the Lord. Yeah. And the assistant pastor told me, they counted it up, like, I think over the period of those 3 weeks, they counted up like there were about 500 conversions. Mm-hmm. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful revival. But I remember you were there, and your mother, Mary Ann, was one of my greatest encouragers, always, till all the way up to her death.
Yeah.
She was. Then your dad, did he come to those meetings too? I can't remember if he...
I don't know that he did at that time. I think probably somewhere along the way he had heard you speak sometime yeah. when you were there. But right. he was a leader in our church, in yeah. the Presbyterian church, and they stayed Presbyterians all the way up until after Dad died.
Yeah.
And then a year later, Mom moved her over to Lamb's Chapel.
Lamb's Chapel.
And
yeah.
so she loved it when you were at Lamb's Chapel, and she was at Lamb's Chapel. That was a good thing.
You know, I preached your mom. I sang at your mom's funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember, your mom was one of these people that if she felt God was telling her something, I mean, she obeyed.
Yes, she did.
And sometimes in kind of unorthodox ways and all. But we were riding home from Lamb's Chapel when we were going there. And I was living out in Lee County. It was like a 40-minute drive. And we were riding home, and my son, who you know, he's about 8 years old. And he just announced, he said, "That lady sitting behind us in church tapped me on the shoulder." And he said, "She said, the Lord told me to give you a $10 bill. So he said, look what I got." He said, "I really like this church."
I really like that lady, too.
Yeah. But she was just that way. And
yes, she was.
And Susie, I remember a year later, David Stevenson asked me to come back down, and I just spoke on a Sunday, I think, and your brother came.
Yes, he did.
He didn't come. I think he was in college, maybe, during that revival.
No, he was still in high school.
But he wasn't interested in it, right?
Well, actually, I think God was stirring his heart, and just in his own testimony of saying that he wasn't going to that altar. But he did tell God that if you ever came back, then he would go to that altar and give his life to God.
You're kidding me.
Thinking that that was a one in a million and he was probably safe.
Because I was living in Indiana. I didn't know that.
But the next October, so it would have been October of 1971, when, lo and behold, you came.
And he told his mother. He said, "You know what, Mom? Nothing's going to, I remember your mom told me this, nothing's going to get in the way of basketball. You know, I might go, but basketball is number one in my life." And he came to the Lord.
Yeah.
And tell the people what happened the rest of his life.
Well, he became a pastor.
A Lutheran pastor.
No, Presbyterian.
I'm
pastor.
So sorry. I thought it was Lutheran. Of course, why would I say Lutheran? Presbyterian.
Yeah, we grew up Presbyterian, but yeah.
Yeah. But God was great. So that's how I got to know you.
I've got my hand on the plow, and I'm walking straight ahead. I've got no reason to look back. I'm moving forward instead. I've got no interest in the past. There's a purpose for it all, and a mission to fulfill. I intend to press.
You're listening to a podcast called Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning. We've been listening to a conversation I had a few days ago with Artie and Susan Hall, who are friends of mine who I've known for over 50 years. We just heard a song called Hand on the Plow, and Artie and Susan have been servants of Jesus for many years, all the way back to their teenage years. So let's return to that conversation.
You were both part of a church, which was a very prosperous, booming church that had a big split. And there was some moral failure and that sort of thing.
There was.
And you ended up going to Lamb's Chapel. Lamb's Chapel started from the kind of the ashes of that.
Right.
Did you ever feel like all your years in the church that fell apart? Did you ever feel like, was that a waste?
Oh no. There are no wasted years in the Lord. He is always doing something. And you know, even though the leadership in that situation ended up being morally compromised and just some character issues and a lot of things, so it all fell apart. But in the midst of all that were some really, really good people.
Absolutely.
And all of those folks just kind of found a place around Florence. And then Lonnie and I, we both had resigned because we both were there. Sue was there as well. And that was December of 88, we resigned. And Lonnie hung in there another week or two. And at that point, starting January of 89, we had nowhere to go. I mean, we kind of looked at each other like, what are we going to do now? The last thing either of us wanted to do was start a church.
Yeah.
And he ended up calling, you know, five or six other families. And we all were there, and that was the beginning of Lamb's Chapel in his downstairs living room.
And Lonnie Curls.
At his house.
Lonnie was on the show last week.
And so it just kind of happened. You know, we all end up down there, and after a month, there were 100 people there or more. And at that point, we knew, well, I guess something has started whether we want it to or not.
Right. And, so you never got jaded in the whole deal, like
not really
disillusioned. How about you?
You know, I belong to the Lord. It. I mean, there were things that hurt my feelings, but you know, you live through it, and you just go on with life.
That's the thing. If you're grounded in the Lord, you're going to go on with the Lord. But I've seen so many just get disillusioned and say, "Well, forget it." You know.
Well,
I think for me, it was hard.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard. My role at that time, there was a Christian school there, and I had left teaching public school to be there with the Christian school. Our children were there in school. Artie was on the pastoral staff and then involved with the teaching with the school. And, you know, to walk away from something in the middle of the school year was hard.
Yeah.
And I can remember a lot of night hours just with tears. God, what has happened? And why is this happening? And how is this, you know, not in turning away from God, but in turning to God and trying to walk through it and understand it. And I couldn't understand it. There's no understanding. You know, none of us are perfect people. Yeah. But that doesn't change Jesus Christ being perfect.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Christians, it's pulling to Him and pulling close to Him. So it was, you know, it was a tough time to start over and look for new teaching jobs and get our kids in school and all those changes. The thing that I think is amazing, and I may be talking before you get the chance, in 2007, we went to Nicaragua.
Mm. Yeah, I want to get to that too, yeah.
And Artie was involved in a teaching ministry at the church there in Nicaragua. And I was principal at a Christian school.
That's right.
So it's like those things that were lost when this church went through all of that disaster, I guess. It really was. But all of that fell apart. okay, it's almost 20 years later. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, here's this restoration. Here, I'll give you this back. I'm going to put you back into this again. And it was like, oh, wow. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of growing in between all of those times.
Oh, yeah. So you said it was 20 years later?
Well, it was from 1988 18. To 2007 when we moved to Nicaragua.
Yeah,
I like the way you say that. Say Nicaragua. I can't say. I say Nicaragua. Yeah.
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua.
Yeah, Nicaragua.
I could never learn how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
We had to learn some Spanish while we were there.
Yeah, we ended up doing all that. But
and your major in college was philosophy, wasn't it?
Greek. It was classical Greek, the language. I did end up doing some philosophy stuff just with...
At the University of South Carolina?
University of South Carolina, but it's classical Greek. And
you made an A in it?
Pretty much. Yeah. I was a much better college student than I was high school student.
Already. I made 2 D's in college. One of them was Greek. Guess what the other one was? Bowling.
Oh, bowling. Well, I might make a D in that too.
I lost my paper. All you had to do was turn your score papers in. I lost them, so I got a D. But yeah, so that really wasn't the kind of major that guaranteed a job.
Oh no! We were married. We had, and then I was going to go to graduate school then, but then the first baby comes along, and whole life changes at that point. You know, you just have to be a grown up and go out and start doing stuff. And
so you taught school too, both of you.
Yeah, there, we right? did. Both
here in town.
Here in the area, I have taught every grade from fifth grade up to postgraduate students. At some point in my teaching career, I've had kids and adults. Sometimes there's not much difference.
So what school did you teach at here in town?
First, we moved here to teach at the what would have been in those years Tabernacle Bible Institute.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I started teaching at what was Christian Assembly School. I'm not sure if it's still here or not.
Okay.
But that's what it was then. And and from that, went to be an assistant principal at a public school in Lamar, and then did a bunch of public education till we moved back to Columbia when I went back to school.
Okay. What school, what grade did you teach?
I started teaching at Spring Elementary in Darlington, which is the school I went to when I was in elementary school, which was fun. And then we were involved at the Christian school here, and then I taught a semester at Darlington High School in that transition time, and taught 8 years at Timrod Elementary as sixth graders.
Yeah.
Then we moved to Columbia when Artie went back to school to get a second master's in Old Testament. And I was at Summit Parkway Middle School for 10 years.
You know, I never liked Timrod School, and I'll tell you why. Some people stole my my car, my Blazer. It was kind of like a, I don't know if you'd call it SUV, but
yeah,
I left it in the parking lot of Lamb's Chapel overnight. It's a long story, but Trish had an accident, and we dropped her son off for one of the Cub Scout kind of things. And so I said, let's just go out and eat, and we'll pick the car up tomorrow. Well, tomorrow the car was gone, and they found it burned to a crisp in a field near Timrod's school. I don't have good memories of Timrod. Yeah.
But it wasn't my students, okay?
No, of course it was.
No. Hopefully not.
Tell me if this is right. Someone came and told me, talking about you, I guess about both of you, that you had a dream to go into missions for a long time before you went. Is that right?
I did. The Lord had put that, in fact, when that youth conference, just part of the calling that I was feeling at the time was for some sort of missionary work.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how that was going to look. And when I got to USC, you know, I ended up taking Greek classes because it was just about all you could do there at the time that was even vaguely related. And I knew that we had a lot of sending people that we in the Bible college, ultimately here in Florence where I was teaching, we sent people in mission field all the time.
Yeah.
So a lot of people went out, and But we never did. It just, we, a couple of times we'd make an effort to explore and look at some stuff and just, and it just never worked out. It, you know, it was never a thing. And at that point, I kind of thought, well, maybe that's just not the thing, you know, and we, you know, you make your life. You just, it, it is, you can either just, you know, grumble about stuff, or you just say, Lord, I'm yours, and whatever you want me to do is fine. And you know, so you come to peace with that. And I, at some point when I went back to school, missionary stuff was not even really on the radar. I was looking more in the, at the point of maybe getting a job in a college here in the States, or, you know, something like that, just college level teaching. And so I went in that direction, and the whole Nicaraguan thing just kind of, it just happened. It was one of those things that was not particularly planned, but it just happened.
You weren't rattling the door trying to go there.
No, no, no. In fact, it was not even a thought. The story of Nicaragua is just interesting. I had begun, I finished up PhD in 2002, I think it was, thereabouts. And then I was all dressed up, nowhere to go. So I put some feelers out looking for a job, just nothing opened up. And I taught high school for a year after that, because just sort of looking for something to do. And then it opened up for me to travel with an older brother, an older guy, Glenn Anderson. In fact, I traveled with him. I did a South Asia trip to Malaysia, Sri Lanka, Thailand. You know, I was there about a month. I did some teaching there, you know, just Old Testament survey stuff, just some other things. And nothing, just nothing. Came back. Had sort of thought that, well, let's just see. I had a couple of feelers out, maybe a job with a Christian school, just some other stuff. And Glenn had one more trip. He was going to go to Nicaragua. So I went with him. And now understand, the thing about Glenn, he loved to travel, but he would describe himself as, I'm really, you know, other than the fact that I can't hear, can't walk, can't see, other than that, I'm doing okay. And that's just kind of where he was. And my job with the family was to bring the body back if he died. You know, they were just worried about it.
And was he old?
He's old. By then, and not in great shape. He was in his 70s, which is not that old, but at the time, he was not in great physical shape. But so I went with him to Nicaragua. And I was going to do a series on the life of Christ with the church there. And, you know, in the first couple of days, you know, it was just sort of a little trip. Here we are. You know, I'm still thinking something's going to happen in the States. And one of the days when we had some free time, there was a church right outside of the huge city dump in Managua where probably 3,000-4,000 people would live. This little old lady had a church there. She was from the coast. In Nicaragua, the people on the coast, the Atlantic coast, are English-speaking. And she's a little Pentecostal church, a little Pentecostal lady. And I went over to that church. Just, we were visiting. She, you know, we were going to do whatever. And we walked in that little building. And the presence of God was just you could just feel it. I mean, it was just almost one of those, you know, there are moments in life when the Lord really lets you know he's there.
Yeah.
So there it is. I'm kind of going, man, this is interesting. Went up, and as I walked upstairs there, this lady, little old lady, takes me by the hand. She speaks English. So she began to prophesy and spoke to me that the Lord had placed a love in my heart for Nicaragua, and that God was dealing with me about that, and that he was going to show me what to do with that love for Nicaragua. And, you know, at that point, I'm kind of going, okay. You know, and I mean, the real presence of the Lord and all that, but even at that, I'm going, oh, okay, we'll see what happens with that. But what happened later that day is that very feeling of a love for that country seized my heart. And I'm sitting in the front with the driver who doesn't speak any English because we were going somewhere. And, you know, I'm just beginning to weep. And I'm looking at this place like it has always been home. It was disorienting the way I was feeling that. It's like, this is home. This is home. You know, and I'm going, this is the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me, Lord. And because I'm not a real emotional kind of guy. You know, so I'm crying. I get back to the place where the fellow that I'm staying, who had been in Nicaragua since 1980, great guy. He became my best friend, and I worked with him, and we had a great time. But he's looking at me like, "What are you having a nervous breakdown here? I mean, what's the deal?" You know, because I'm just going, "I don't know what to do." You know, I mean, I don't know what to do. You know, and I really didn't. I didn't know what to do with it. But I said, you know, I can't ignore this. This is, you know, the Lord doesn't always write things in the sky. But that was one of those moments where, okay, we got to go to Nicaragua. I don't know what I'm going to do here, but we got to go.
So did you not feel this burden for Nicaragua until she gave that prophecy?
Yeah, it was a word of God that came in my heart with that thing.
But in other words, when she spoke, before she spoke it, it wasn't really there
on that. No, not at all. You know, I mean, this
thing, she kind of spoke it into existence.
That was kind of how this went. And she's a neat lady. She has passed on since, and we would take other teams out there and cook a few other things. I didn't know what to do with that.
How long after that did your guys move?
About a year. Mm-hmm. You know, we started.
What did you think, Susan, when he came home and said?
This is the interesting part as well.
I mean, backing up, because when he finished with his PhD in biblical studies, we were thinking Christian college somewhere in the U.S., that's where we're going. You know, I'm at my school and as a middle school curriculum specialist by then, just like, and we had been praying. I mean, you know, those prayers that are so on your heart, you just kind of breathe them in and out. You're always praying, God, what do you want us to do? What do you have us do? What do you want us to do? And while he was in Sri Lanka that month that he was gone, it was like, is this it? Is this it? Is this it? And he's like, nice people, great work. They love Jesus. This isn't it. And so I'm like, all right, we're still praying. And while he was in Nicaragua, I know exactly because I had a sixth grade math class that I was teaching. So I had taught that class. And on the way back from that class, back to my office, there was this, wait a minute, what just happened? And I remember I stopped in the hallway and I was like, what is going on?
You just felt something.
But it was just like that burden to pray.
Yeah.
God, what would you have us do? Was all of a sudden gone. You know, and he's in Nicaragua. I'm supposed to be praying for him, but it was like I couldn't even really work up a prayer because it was just...
You just had peace.
It was just, whoosh, that was gone. And when he got home, we compared notes, and it was about the same time that the Lord was speaking to his heart.
Literally the same time.
Were your children grown by that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is what the person told me about your call. It's actually your neighbor. Who is your neighbor now? Ellen.
Oh, okay.
She said that it was a real testimony, your life, both of your life, that you felt this calling for missions, and yet you were faithful doing, not mundane, but doing the
things. Yeah.
Making a living, paying the bills, raising your children.
Yeah.
You waited, and you were faithful, doing the little things, even though it wasn't part of the big picture.
Yeah.
But it's like the verse, he who is faithful in a few things, I'll make faithful in many. And when it was the right timing, he launched you over there. And you were there for 13 years, you told me.
13 years.
Yeah.
And you were principal of a school. Mm-hmm. Were you pastor of a church?
I ultimately became the assistant to the director of Iglesia Verbo in Nicaragua. It was Misión Cristiana Verbo. It was started in 1980. The fellow that started was a fellow named Bob Trolis and Bob and Myra. They had one son when they moved there, He's from California originally, and he became a Christian out of the Jesus movement. They were out of the gospel outreach movement with Jim Durkin.
I've heard Jim Durkin speak several times.
Yeah, and
quite a guy.
He was, you know, the assemblies in those years, and they came initially to Guatemala, where he worked on a building project after the earthquake, and then in 1980, literally when every United States missionary and everybody else was leaving the country because of all the Contra and Sandinista war that started shortly after that, he's moving into the country. He and this one other lady, who was Mennonite, I think, they were literally the only North Americans in Nicaragua for about 10 years. And so he raised his kids there. You know, they were there and started this. We had, 15 churches and an orphanage, Christian schools. There was the orphanage on a farm outside of town. And
in Managua.
In Managua. So, you know, it had grown. And I became the sort of the resident teacher in the ministry there for training the pastors for we even started a little Bible Institute, just some other stuff that we had going.
Well, you have a great teaching gift,
and
I mean, you really do.
It took a while. I had to get up to speed because I didn't know anything about Spanish. I've done a number of languages through the year, but I never did anything with Spanish. So I was starting from scratch with that, and initially, I would use a translator, an interpreter for classes. And then, I was about 6 months, and I finally got to the point where they kind of said, your Spanish is okay. It's kind of ugly, but it's okay. We know what you're talking about, so it's fine. You don't really need a translator anymore. And I had to learn. So you just, and when you're immersed and you don't have any choice, because it was a complete Nicaraguan work. The only North American in it was Bob. And I became the other guy, the other, U.S. citizen in the office. And, out of that, I sort of ultimately became I wasn't the assistant director because I never had a title. I used to sometimes describe myself as sometimes I'd say I'm friend of Bob, because that was so much what I would do, because he'd been there alone for so many years, and they lived through the whole war. It was just a lot of things, and there are just aspects of dealing with property, dealing with the government that was getting even crazy at that point. Just difficult for him, and he just needed somebody else that could sit in there, observe, help, and we'd make decisions and those kinds of things, and I kind of became the other gringo in the office.
So you came back to the United States what year?
2020. It was COVID related.
Then your mother was her health was going down. Or had she already died by then?
She had already died. She died in December of 2016.
Okay, so that wasn't an issue.
Yeah,
But because of COVID,
it just fell apart.
Well, my school was, with everything, pandemic. We can all know where were we when the pandemic started, and we were there, and things were already starting to shut down, close down, concerns about contagion. Nobody knew what we were dealing with. And our school got permission from the government to be virtual for the rest of the school year. And airlines were even announcing they were going to stop flying. And so Artie was like, we have to go. So we left, came back to the States. We were thinking we would be right back before the new school year started, and that was a no and a no and a no, and we didn't get back. So I ended up working a whole year remotely as a principal of a school that was meeting on campus, because the next school year we were hybrid, half and half. We had students who were all virtual and students on campus.
And you were the principal Here?
No, I was living here, principal of the school in Nicaragua,
oh, it was nuts.
Spending my life on the computer every day with emails and Zoom calls and arrange the parent conference, arrange the student conference. And, you know, that was just what we did. And then retired at the end of that year. That was your number 39 in education. And that was enough.
You're bearing fruit right now. It's like 13 years, but your ministry didn't end when you moved back here. It's still going.
There's stuff going on.
You know, when people invest in your life, it's forever. Yeah. And there are people who invested in my life as a teenager and all the way through. And what they sowed in me, I'm thankful for.
Yeah.
Because it means I now can live
my
life in a way as much as I can to honor God.
I want to thank my friends, Dr. Artie Hall and Susan Hall, for sharing their journey of faith with us on the show tonight. I also want to thank my friend, Brian Hoogenboom, for engineering this show week after week. I want to close the show tonight with a song I wrote back in the 1980s called I'd Be a Fool. I recorded it on an album in 1997, but a couple of years ago, I sat down at a keyboard in a studio in Indiana and just sang an intimate version of it, just me and my 88 friends and me singing straight to Jesus. This is I'd Be a Fool. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll listen next week. God bless.
I'd be a fool not to love you. I'd be a fool not to care. I'd be a fool to forget you. I'd be a fool to even dare. Memories still linger of my life apart from you. I'd be a fool not to love you, Jesus, and love you I do. I'd be a fool not to love you. After what I've seen, I would be a fool not to follow you. After I was wandering in the darkness, oh yes I was. Then I heard you call. I'd be a fool not to give my life to you. After all, precious Jesus, I'm singing this song to you. Let them laugh if they want to. Let them go ahead and have their fun. I'll be a fool in the eyes of men. Oh, but what you've done. And I've seen one too many miracles. Oh yes I have. Do you ever say it isn't true? I'd be a fool not to love you, Jesus, and love you I do. I would be a fool not to love you, Jesus, and you know that I do. Me and my 88 friends.